Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, October 13th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. On Wednesday this past week, Lyndon LaRouche delivered another in his series of historic webcasts. This one is archived on the LaRouchePack.com website, so you can download it or listen to it at your leisure. But during the webcast, he spoke directly and bluntly about the dangerous course of our nation under Cheney and his puppet Bush, from their threats to extend their failed war in Iraq to Iran, their provocations against Russia, and their criminal and deliberate mismanagement of the economy, which is already in an advanced stage of collapse. He also spoke equally bluntly about the disastrous failures of the Congress to counter the Cheney-Bush policies, with some what I would describe as well-chosen words for Speaker Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. We'll be discussing these issues and more on the program today, including the progress toward passage of the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act with our panel. But first, I want to start with the overarching strategic concern raised by Mr. LaRouche on Wednesday, that of the central role of the British Empire in directing the Cheney-Bush administration on this destructive course, including what he said about the British-Saudi role in 9/11. Joining us today to discuss this is our world-class strategic analyst, Jeffrey Steinberg, whose article in the October 12th EIR, Britain's Managed Chaos Drives the World Toward War, provides insight into the nature of this problem. Also with us today are LIM members, LaRouche Youth Movement members, Delonte Bess from the editorial staff in Leesburg, Virginia, and Nick Walsh in Houston. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Harley.
One of the points Lyndon has made repeatedly is one which you took up in your article, in which you write that many well-meaning and patriotic Americans, including many within the top echelons of the military, the intelligence community, and the diplomatic corps, lack the depth of historical insight to fathom the British agenda. We want to discuss this today to get to the heart of this, but let me start by just asking you, what exactly is this British agenda?
Well, I think that there's two aspects to it. Number one, a long-term commitment to destroy the United States, both for historical as well as current reasons. Historically, the United States not only broke free of the British Empire, but with the Constitution of 1787, the United States established a principle of republicanism that represents the worst and most frightening enemy of the British system, which is a system of oligarchical control in which the interests, the general welfare of the vast majority of people are completely ignored. And, you know, most human beings are to be treated as either chattel slaves or beasts of burden.
Would you consider this a principle of the British system?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a philosophical principle. It's a principle of organization of empire. It wasn't invented by the British. The British adopted a model that is, you know, virtually as old as history. And you've had this historic struggle between those who promote the idea of a true republic, which is an organization of government aimed at providing the opportunity for people to realize their truly human identities as creative individuals capable of making unique discoveries about the nature of man in the universe and changing the world. So a republican form of government dating back to the time of Socrates and Plato is a government which attempts to create the maximum opportunities for an educated population to change the world. That is the antithesis of empire. And what you see today with the British Empire is an attempt to revive and sort of extract the most effective past experiences of imperial rule. And so you've got what Mr. LaRouche also refers to as the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, which is a system of financial control, manipulation of cultures, and various kinds of non-human, subhuman identities, tribal identities, ethnic, racial identities that can be exploited and manipulated, pitting one people against another. So you have a historical legacy that certain circles within the leading oligarchy of Britain, and by which I don't mean the man on the street, who is by and large a victim of this system, but among certain City of London and other leading British circles, they see in the Bush-Cheney administration the greatest opportunity to bring about the induced self-destruction of the United States. So that's been one critical agenda that carries a long history. The second issue is that we're in the end phase of the entire global financial monetary system that represented the overthrow of Franklin Roosevelt's concept of the Bretton Woods system that was implemented in 1944. The system came under attack and began to erode the moment of Roosevelt's death in April 1945, but held its own over a number of years, by and large, in terms of allowing for certain general benefits from a fixed exchange rate system that protected the sovereign control over currencies, allowed for investment in development. That ended with the assassination of John Kennedy, and then decisively came to a screeching halt with the George Shultz, Paul Volcker, Henry Kissinger manipulation of the Nixon administration in August 1971 to formally break the Bretton Woods system and set up a floating exchange rate system where national currencies became commodities to be speculated on. So they know that system is ended, and therefore they understand that the issue on the table now is raw political power. To be in a position to control the restructuring of the system that is inevitable because we're in the closing moments of the present dollar-based world financial superstructure. It's already crumbling in many places, and it's really only a matter of days, weeks, or months before the whole thing blows through some dramatic event. You can't predict where and when, but you can see it coming from a distance.
Well, Jeff, now let me ask you, because the point of change that you identified, the period between November 1963 and August 1971, much of that change was carried out through networks in the United States. In particular, you mentioned Shultz, Kissinger, and Volcker. I think we could throw Greenspan into that in the more recent phase of that. But these are nominally Americans. So you're saying that they're functioning in a sense as operatives of this British, this Anglo-Dutch imperial system.
That's right. And let me sort of fill that out a bit in two different ways. Number one, in May of 1982, Henry Kissinger performed a very useful service. He went to London and he spoke at a conference at Chatham House, the Royal Institute. And in that speech, he basically bragged about the fact that he was always much closer to the British outlook and to the British policy establishment than anybody in the United States. And he basically drew a sharp distinction between the outlook of Winston Churchill, which he wholeheartedly embraced, and the outlook of President Franklin Roosevelt, who he said made the terrible mistake of trying to introduce a moral dimension to politics and to foreign policy. So, in effect, Kissinger said, I stand foursquare with the British outlook and despise and ridicule the American outlook as last best expressed by FDR. So Schultz, Volcker, all of these people, to one degree or another, I could make the same case that these guys are self-consciously agents of a British outlook and British philosophy inside the United States. That doesn't mean that Henry Kissinger walks around with a glossy card in his wallet designating him as, you know, 008 or something like that, some British secret agent.
Only in his mind.
Right. But it does mean that from the standpoint of outlook, these people represent the British system, not the American. Now, to just sort of take a second approach to the exact same issue. Yesterday, we celebrated what's called James Fenimore Cooper Day. I'm not sure if it was his birthday or some other commemorative date, but we had a discussion here in the office. What was it, 2 days ago, Thursday? Yeah, it was Thursday, not yesterday. James Fenimore Cooper was not only one of the great American writers, but James Fenimore Cooper was one of our leading intellectuals and intelligence operatives on behalf of the American system, on behalf of this Republican philosophical and political outlook that was at the heart of the American Revolution and the system that was established with our federal constitution. Cooper's writings, particularly during the period from 1826 through about 1832 or 33, when he traveled widely all over Europe, usually in the company of Samuel Morse, provides some of the best and clearest identification of the difference in outlook between the American Republican outlook and the British oligarchical outlook. And so this quality of understanding about what the real nature of the political struggle was, regardless of the immediates of the conflicts playing out, this underlying issue of the dispute and the irreconcilable difference between the American Republican outlook and the European, but particularly Anglo-Dutch, City of London, British outlook of oligarchism is really an essential point. And I would urge all of the listeners of this show to test that out. Pick up some of Cooper's writings. Pick up, for example, his book, The Bravo, about Venice. Or pick up his book, The Spy, which was based on real events that took place during the American Revolution. There's many others I could recommend. All of his travelogues from Europe when he traveled around, where he wrote back extensive essays that were really in-depth political intelligence reports. That will give you an idea of a quality of thinking that has been largely lost among our leading political circles today. So you've got the extreme cases of people like George Shultz, or say on the Democratic Party side, like Felix Rohatyn or Al Gore, who have gone totally over to the British outlook and who don't need to get secret phone calls and, you know, code books and things like that. They think the way that the British oligarchy thinks, and therefore they function as agents of that outlook inside the American political process.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is Jeffrey Steinberg, who's one of the editors of the Executive Intelligence Review and a longtime associate of Lyndon LaRouche. If you want to send an email question to Jeff, you can send that to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And we're willing and happy to take your questions as they come in. Now, Jeff, this is this discussion of the two different approaches and also the British sabotage. The question has come up from Georgie Ann Geyer most recently, an article, I believe, in the International Herald Tribune on the question of how the United States was suckered by the British into the Iraq War. you have this very dramatic development in the last days of the British announcing they're going to pull out of Basra. And she makes a point, which I believe you made a long time ago, that if you turn Basra over to Shiite militia, that's the land route of escape for Americans. Or to leave Iraq, that's the land route into Kuwait. That's going to be in the hands of hostile forces. So is this part of the same tradition of the British creating a crisis? We go in headlong into it, and we're left holding the bag?
Exactly. And you know, I think the best term to describe how the British are functioning at this moment in this extended Southwest Asia, Persian Gulf zone of crisis and war is the term managed chaos. They don't want to necessarily blow things completely out of control. But how do they operate inside Iraq, inside this Shiite region in the south? First of all, you know, the U.S. has concentrated much of its military force in the Anbar and Diyala provinces in the Sunni area of Iraq, which is largely a desolate Bedouin area. The British, who came in as the nominal junior partners in the effort, said, we'll take charge of the south, the Shiite area. Of course, the Shiites are the majority population in Iraq. And the area in the south, particularly around the port of Basra, happens to be the center of the existing oil sector inside Iraq. Basra is the port of exit for all of the Iraqi oil going out onto the international markets. It's nowhere near what it was before the U.S. invasion, but it's about 1.2 million barrels a day going out of Basra. There's a significant black market component to that. And what the British did in the south is they told the rival Shiite factions, Muqtada al-Sadr, the Hakim group, and others, we respect the fact that you guys are fighting it out for power. We're going to step back. We're not going to get in the middle of it. We're not going to take sides. And all we want to make sure is that there's no needless attacks against British forces, and understand that whoever's the fair winner in this fight, Britain's going to align and back them up. So they're positioning themselves both with Iran and with these Shiite groups in the south to have a controlling relationship, no matter what the outcome. And, of course, they didn't make any effort to turn that area securely over to the government forces. Wasn't even on their agenda. They just said, you know, fair fight, whoever wins, we're going to back you after the fact when the dust settles. That's a typical kind of divide-and-conquer imperial game. And so the British are looking to allow a certain level of chaos. Now, I'd also say, watch out for Tony Blair. You know, one of the, you know, more impressive acts of stupidity on the part of President Bush was that without even consulting with the Europeans, the UN, or the Russians, Bush just sort of foisted Tony Blair as he was leaving the prime ministership in Britain into the position of being the key negotiator for the quartet on the Israel-Palestine situation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Blair is in a position to be a kind of a wrecking ball. And, you know, Tony Blair is Mr. BAE, al-Yamama, mm-hmm. British-Saudi, off-budget, dirty arms for oil deals. So that's the confluence of power in London that Blair is working for. And Bush, in his infinite stupidity, just handed Blair a key position where he can be a kind of a guarantor that you don't get an absolute breakthrough in the peace process.
Jeff, before we bring in the LIM panel members, which I want to do in a few moments, I want to just focus for a moment on the Russian situation, where the Russians have been warning recently in their press of traditional British operations against Russia. Yesterday, President Putin gave some very stern comments to Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Gates on the deployment of U.S. So-called anti-missile systems in Eastern Europe. How are the British playing the Russian side of things?
Well, first of all, for the City of London oligarchy, the idea of any kind of a restoration of a U.S.-Russian strategic partnership, particularly if it also brings along closer cooperation with China and India, is an existential threat. Because many times before in recent history, since the time of the American Revolution, you've had a U.S.-Russian partnership that always ran contrary to British imperial interests. You had Catherine the Great at the time of the American Revolution organizing the League of Armed Neutrality, which was a critical moment. And it was a critical intervention to secure the flow of critical supplies to the American revolutionaries. You had, in response to that, in 1807, the first American diplomatic delegation going to St. Petersburg, Russia, headed up by John Quincy Adams, and he was there for 5 or 6 years. Very important in terms of sealing long-term bonds of collaboration. The Russian Navy, in its entirety, was sent to New York and San Francisco to back up Abraham Lincoln during the American Civil War. And Tsar Alexander II had sent along secret orders to with the Russian naval commanders that if Britain entered the war on the side of the Confederacy, the entire Russian Navy would come under the command of President Lincoln. And then, of course, you had the FDR collaboration with Stalin during World War II, where they were always counterbalancing the alliance with Britain and Churchill against Hitler and, you know, dealing with constant British attempts to sabotage the whole arrangement. So now you see the British promoting a strong confrontation between Britain and Russia, and peddling the idea that Russia has gone back to a totalitarianism under Putin. At the same time, Putin is trying to establish the groundwork for reviving that long-term U.S.-Russian strategic partnership. And, you know, there's a certain personal leverage that Putin has with Bush that we saw still functioning up in Kennebunkport at the beginning of July, when they had their summit meeting and where Putin put a proposal on the table for strategic cooperation, beginning with strategic missile defense cooperation. All of this is still up in the air. It's pending. But from London's standpoint, a renewal of the U.S.-British genuine strategic partnership is the death knell for the British Empire, because with the U.S. and Russia, and especially with China and India as well, all operating in concert, you have a confluence of power that can defeat the British. If you don't have that U.S.-Russian anchor, then the Brits are still running the show through their various methods borrowed from the Venetians, their power over offshore finance. One of the key crimes that will be looked back on from the Bush administration is that the organized collapse, controlled collapse of the U.S. dollar is dramatic. Since the time that Bush came into office, the U.S. dollar has fallen an average of 38% against some of the other world's leading currencies, especially the British pound sterling, which is worth more than 2-1 over the U.S. dollar, $2 plus for one British pound sterling. This has resulted in a dramatic wealth transfer from the U.S. to the City of London, which is now the number one financial center in the world, tied to the whole offshore financial empire that the British run through a string of crown colonies, from the Cayman Islands to the Grand Bahamas, you name it.
Jeff, let me just ask one more question on this, since I used it as a threw it out as a teaser earlier, which is the British-Saudi role in 9/11. We're seeing interesting things coming out in the last couple of days. Jimmy Carter's attacks on Dick Cheney. Yesterday, General Sanchez, the former U.S. commander in charge of troops in Iraq, fired a blast at the administration for their planning for the war and for the occupation. How long is it going to be? What's it going to take before the whole question of 9/11 is reopened and the role of the Saudis and the British behind them are looked into?
Well, I think Lynn did a great service and put the issue foursquare on the table with the webcast last Wednesday. And I think it's very indicative that we have gotten some extraordinary responses from around the world to what Mr. LaRouche did on Wednesday at the webcast. Because around the world, you've got people who have had a far more recent disastrous experience in coming up against the invisible power of the British Empire. I think it's quite significant. Look, if you look at the Russians and look at what's been going on in Chechnya over the past decade, you get a very clear idea of how this Anglo-Saudi operation works in practice. The Russians, back in 2000, filed a series of diplomatic protests, démarches, with the British government because they knew that the British government was turning a blind eye to the fact that Muslims in Britain were being recruited like crazy to go into Chechnya and to be part of the separatist insurgency operations that were overwhelmingly financed and supported through the Wahhabite clergy in Saudi Arabia and many Saudi businessmen aligned with that apparatus. If you go back historically, the British were there on the ground floor of the launching of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, you know, a dominant factor in organizations like Al-Qaeda. Just to end this on a real quick anecdote, if you even read the report of the 9/11 Commission, particularly the interim staff reports that were produced while the investigation was going on. There was one particular report I remember. I read it very carefully. It was the debriefing of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the basically the organizer of the 9/11 plot, at least as the official story goes. So I found it very interesting that the 9/11 Commission staff report said, well, one of the first things the guy told us is that he joined the Muslim Brotherhood at the age of 16 and remains an active member of it. So there was a conference at the U.S. Senate several months later where they brought together purportedly a whole bunch of experts on Al-Qaeda and 9/11. And I asked the question from the floor. I cited this staff report and I said, can you describe to me what the relationship is between the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda? And it drew a blank from all the so-called experts. So, you know, you can delve very deeply into this question of how the British have historically played the great game in the extended area of Southwest and Central Asia. And you find that they've historically played the tribal, ethnic, and religious fundamentalist cards to create the conditions for permanent conflict that you can manipulate. You want to get the Kurdish problem solved that's now threatening to actually erupt into an actual border war between Turkey and Iraq with the U.S. military caught in the middle? Go at this British question. Go at how the British have historically played this Greater Kurdistan game, how they've played Greater Baluchistan, all of these non-existent entities that they've created in order to have an opportunity on a moment's notice to instigate crises among sovereign governments because they've created artificial borders with the Sykes-Picot agreements at the end of World War I. that made sure that all of these ethnic, religious, tribal, and cultural fault lines were established. So, you know, just add water, count to five, and you've got a war going.
Well, and it was Churchill himself who bragged about how he established the modern nation of Iraq by carving it out of the old Mesopotamia, Syria, Lebanon, as aftermath of Sykes-Picot.
Yep.
So with Lynn having launched this renewed challenge and salvo against the British-Saudi axis, I think we should be looking forward to more from you and the EIR on this in the coming weeks. I want to bring in now the Lynn panel, and actually I'd like to start with Delonte Bess, because I think that if you've followed what we've been discussing so far with Jeffrey Steinberg and the aftermath of Lyndon LaRouche's webcast, we're taking up this question of how you educate a population which has been subjected to years of brainwashing and years of disorientation, so they can't even recognize reality. And Delonte, you've had a responsibility in the recent period to work and develop the website, the LaRouche PAC website, to carry out this process of education. So what have you been, what's your experience, and what, how do you think this is working, and where are you headed with the website?
Well, right now we're, as Jeff had laid out very clearly around this British imperialistic question, one thing we've come up on that goes hand in hand with the British Empire's geopolitical games is the cultural destruction, as you just pointed out. And there's no coincidence that the very same people who are playing and carving up the world with these kinds of games have created a condition in which they've had populations like the United States induce themselves to destroy their own human qualities and thinking. And so, and they've done it through various means. I mean, one being radical fundamentalism and religious fundamentalism. The other being, you know, this kind of internet, you know, cyber virtual world culture. And you've had, and the other one is more centered around the musical sort of rock drugs, what they call the rock drug sex counterculture, and they all have been three different kinds of tears that have been spoon-fed, I would say, into primarily the American population to the means of getting them to culturally destroy themselves in order for these kinds of political operations that go on that Jeff just laid out. And so one thing we're doing in editorial as well as in terms of the youth counterintelligence is that we're looking at how this internet culture has been utilized, what's the underlying background and intention behind it. And ironically enough, we're using it as a means of educating people and instilling LaRouche's concepts, political ideas, et cetera, et cetera. But we've seen the different reaction and backlash of that, where the internet has been used primarily, at least for the last 30 or so years, to be a mass social networking trap, especially for our generation. And you see this through the means of things like MySpace, YouTube, Wikipedia, which is sort of the new kind of ministry of truth.
Hey, Delonte, let me give you an example. I was just talking to a top Democrat in California the other day about the problem they're having with their youth recruitment. Mm. Namely, they have no youth recruitment.
Right.
And he said he gave a challenge to the young Democrats of California to come up with an idea for youth recruitment. And you know what their proposal was? Use Facebook.
Facebook, yeah, yeah.
And he said, how can you – he said, you can maybe get information to someone that a meeting's taking place on the internet, but you can't replace face-to-face organizing and dialogue on the internet.
Yeah.
So using the website, how do we besides the role of exposing, what else can we do with that?
Well, with our website, we're, what what we've been able to do is get the kind of feedback, because the crisis is the political and economic crisis so deepening, we're getting a tremendous response from the base of the population, the lower 80%, the state-level legislators. They're feeding back comments, responses, and all sorts of things that will give us a real consideration of what is necessary for us to change our orientation of outside organizing as well. So our slugs, or our so-called political briefings that we place on a website, we want to give people a better, higher-level conceptual sense of what is not being portrayed in the mass media.
Mm-hmm.
We're giving people not just in terms of information, but also you want to bring in things that are culturally more significant for their own sanity, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, things that that are centered around the science work that this youth movement is engaged in, the artistic compositional work, the music, for example. We want to give people the idea of even just something as simply as geography, which I could tell you I has no sense of where things are in the world, where the world is, period.
Uh-huh.
Just looking at a map and being able to locate what these geopolitical operations that the British are running, the British Empire are running, from Russia to the United States to the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is going to be used as a medium, and it is being used as the medium to educate and uplift the population as a whole. I don't know if I had a little bit more time, but this is key. This question of the internet, you really do have to be careful, and I think people have to do the kind of work to go back, because a lot of it, the philosophical underpinnings of the so-called virtual simulation and cybernetics world and internet per se, the philosophy has gone back as far as what Jeff Steinberg was discussing. You see it in the writings of people like Bertrand Russell.
Mm-hmm.
You see it in the writings of people like H.G. Wells' Open Conspiracy. You see it in Aleister Crowley's writings. So the concepts were already there and laid out prior to the digital machine even existing for the 18 to 35 age bracket. And so this is where we have to be clear of what the intention is. Not just being attacking the internet per se, but what is the philosophical intention to induce the population to destroy itself as it is right now?
Well, with that said, I would encourage all of our listeners to go to the LaRouchePack.com website and two or three times a day, because it's now being updated regularly. Delonte and a team of youth movement activists are in there taking in reports. In fact, we just put out a request, I think, for more reports to come in from around the country.
Yep.
On the housing crisis, because you don't get it in the media. Why don't you just tell people what that is, Delonte?
Well, this is the petition that because there's been a huge buildup, as I said, in the base of the population. And so we want people to begin to do the kind of feedbacks where they do see this orientation of a movement going on across the country. And so if you given people this idea of motion that is happening, it does create the kind of excitement and recruitment at the same time. We're recruiting all kinds of people that were in the wings and you may say maybe a little bit scared or just hadn't been contacted. So we have, which is interesting, because our organization is unique, we have the on-ground organizing. We also are using this medium of the website as another tool, as a venue to communicate and pass these kinds of policy discussions like the Homeowners and Bankers Act and various other things along that.
All right, and I'm going to get back to Jeff in just a moment because we have a question on the email I want him to address. And if you have a question for Jeff, there's still time to send it in at radio@larouchepub.com. But speaking of organizing, I'd like to bring in Nick Walsh now, who's been organizing from the West Coast up into Boston, and now recently he's been in Texas. And, Nick, you've listened to Jeff talk about the crisis, the nature of the crisis, the attempt to prevent people from actually understanding what they're facing, Delonte's discussion of how we're intervening with the website. What responses are you getting? Are you finding the population a little more superheated around the collapse and the need to act?
Yeah, I think there's it's a various response. We just got back from Austin, where we were most of this week, at the University of Texas, also meeting with some students that go to community colleges in the area. The main thing I've been noticing, if you just take young people, let's say 18 to 25, you know, bracket, is they really don't have any experience in the real world. And they have a lot of opinions, or they might have theories. And the problem with something like what Delonte is bringing up about the internet culture and the virtual culture and the way that the school classrooms are designed is that the students are being taught and they're living in the kind of relationships with other people where it's all based on, you know, theories. You know, I have a theory about this. Here's this rule. You take political science class, and you get the layout of all the theories of how politics works. And you take science class, and you get the theories, so-called, of how the solar system works. And so on. In economics, you get the theories of monetary theory. But what we're finding with students and the young people is they have no experience actually experimentally investigating reality. For example, they're not political. Most students have not been involved politically. And we've found that bringing this issue to the Kepler work that we're doing, because Kepler, I think, faced a very similar problem in the sense that everyone before him and his contemporaries in the domain of astronomy had just a purely what you call a Euclidean theory or Ptolemaic outlook on the solar system. And they actually emphasized to Kepler that as long as you just have purely mathematical theories about the solar system, we're okay with you. But as soon as you start to say that you know what the physical causes of what's causing motion in the solar system are, or that the minute you say that your system actually is coherent with the thinking of the creator of the universe, or let's say with Holy Scripture, then we have a big problem with what you're doing. And I think we're finding a similar type of fight intellectually or epistemologically with organizing and recruiting youth and getting them involved. There's more to say, but also getting them to understand American history and politics from this standpoint.
I was just going to ask about that, Nick, because I know you've been increasingly interested in American history. And this question that we've been talking about with Jeff in particular, how do you get from someone who might be interested in nuclear power or exploring space to understand that you've got to have a change to the American system of economics?
Yeah, well, we had a great meeting the other night. I don't remember when. Then the last night we were in Austin. We had a few students show up. They watched LaRouche's speech. We watched it. Well, the main discussion afterwards was on the fact that our American culture and American history is actually the expression of this Keplerian, you know, physical scientific approach, physical investigation to the universe, that man exists, human beings are real, the universe is real, and the mind can actually come to know cause and can therefore shape and change nature. And you see, the American history we were fighting with these students about, the United States is not an empire. And in our historical relationships between, like, Washington, Franklin, we were going over, for example, how George Washington, from a very young age, was trained and cultivated to be surveying the western frontier of the colonies. And that was his identity from a very young age, was looking at and starting to map out where human expansion, human increase of population, infrastructure building, city building, industrial production, locations of mines and all these kinds of things, where that would be as we moved west of the Allegheny Mountains into the Ohio River Valley. And he was doing that from the time he was about 16 years old, way before the American Revolution ever happened, back in like 1746. And this was Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin spent a lot of time and wrote a lot about needing to push into the frontier and conquer, transform nature for the benefit of the American system. And that's what we're trying to get the students to realize, is that our system has always been based on increasing the power of man and the welfare of human beings through these through what Lynn's always referred to as increasing our power over nature. And the British system has always been controlling people, mm-hmm. and keeping people from being able to do that, actually pitting people against each other so they'll never collaborate on accomplishing anything good.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of that kind of manipulation, I'd like to come back, bring Jeff back on. There's a question from Santiago Hilaret, Jeff, and he says about Sir Alan Greenspan. He writes that with Greenspan's new book out, he's been doing a lot of talk shows, and he's presenting himself as virtually helpless and clueless in the face of the mortgage meltdown. And so Santiago asks, aren't his comments a lot more significant when looked in the context of the present and the future rather than the past? In other words, isn't he saying that anything, including a massive crash, can happen, but there's nothing that we, the authorities, can do about it? Do you have any comments on Greenspan's recent resurfacing at precisely the moment that his last greatest act of the biggest bubble in world history is blowing out?
Well, he's out there trying to sell a lot of books, so let's not miss the obvious. He's saying some things that have a grain of truth, and therefore, because of that, are totally self-serving. Greenspan came in 1987, right around the time of the big stock market crash that was really the equivalent of the 1929 stock market crash. And from that point on, Greenspan presided over the buildup of the largest series of financial bubbles in history. And so this is the Greenspan who responded to the 1998 LTCM near bankruptcy and follow-on to that with the policy of creating a wall of money. The housing bubble that's now blowing, the subprime mortgages, all of these other exotic mortgages. Go back and read Greenspan's congressional testimony, if you could make hide nor hair out of what he said in those things. And you'll find that he was the biggest proponent of the idea that this growth in, quote, home ownership is one of the, great accomplishments. The bottom line is that within the domain of the kinds of solutions that Greenspan pushes, there is no solution. This system that particularly came into being in its most advanced viral form after 1987, in other words, right at the point Greenspan came in, is finished, it's about to blow, and Greenspan is privy to enough inside information about the process that he himself created so as to know that it is hopelessly bankrupt and it's going to blow.
Well, Jeff, in keeping with the theme of this program for today of the role of the British Empire in subverting the United States, there's been some interesting developments from the Bank of England recently in terms of what we're finding out about their relationship to subprimes and, in a sense, suckering U.S. and European banks to continue to stay in the bubble. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, sure. I mean, look, the fundamental nature of the current British, or you could call it, as Mr. LaRouche does, the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, is that you're not going to make the mistake that brought down Rome and other earlier empires. You're not going to stake everything on your ability to put boots on the ground in these far-flung corners of the world. You're going for control through financial manipulation, through control of things like offshore unregulated financial centers that generate vast hyperinflationary amounts of money out of thin air. And so you know, the British oligarchy, the British financial establishment, knows perfectly well that the system is doomed. And they've got various options. They never put all their eggs in one basket. They've got various options to play out on how to come out the other end of this crisis with power and control. We've been tracking for the last 5 years or so the systematic buildup of British-centered cartels grabbing up control over strategic resources, petroleum, natural gas, precious metals, you name it. And so you've got phenomena like Rio Tinto Zinc and, you know, De Beers Diamonds, the Anglo-American Corporation, which are cartels in the model of the British East India Company, complete with their private armies like Executive Outcome, Defense Systems Limited, and these other, you know, massive mercenary outfits. That's their structure for surviving and prospering at the moment that the world degenerates into fascism and war. So for them, financial power is the key to political power and not the other way around. So they're playing all the angles. They're going for controlled chaos in the Persian Gulf region, which is the world's oil patch, the center of about 70% of the world's known petroleum reserves, is to be found in Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Iraq. And so they're right in the middle of that great game and manipulating things from all sides. They also know that their own oil reserves in the North Sea are running out over the course of the next decade, so that they're profiting handsomely from vastly hyperinflated oil prices in the near term as they profit from not only their grip over the oil flows out of parts of the Persian Gulf, but this whole North Sea phenomenon that's drying out.
Well, and they're also now behind the biofuels bubble, but that's another topic for another show. We have about 8 minutes to go, and I'd like to just bring up a question, the other question we have from the email, and then also see what Delonte and Nick have to say about this. The question is raised by Greg about essentially the relationship between the federal government and the states, and he says that since the federal government seems to be unwilling to act, is there something the states can do? Well, in a slightly different way, what we're seeing is the response of state legislators around the country taking up responsibility for the collapse of the housing bubble and addressing beyond that the protection of the banking system. Wonder, Jeff, if you want to say something on that, and then also if Delonte and Nick want to say something about the organizing for the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act.
Well, look, you know, under the Constitution, and then particularly the way that the Constitution came into practice during the period that Alexander Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury, it was very clearly recognized that you had to, first of all, establish a federal national identity, that the concept embedded in the preamble to the Constitution of the general welfare of all Americans was considered primary. And, you know, we had the experience during the Revolution itself that very often local and regional interests came in conflict with even the objectives of winning the American Revolution. So Hamilton wedded all of the states to the federal government by making sure that in practice only the federal government could actually generate credits and therefore incur debt. And so the states are very much limited in what they can do individually in response to the crisis. So, you know, what Lynn has said is basically that the role of the state, the elected state and local officials, is to kick the ass of Washington into gear to make sure that we return to the outlook and policies that we last fully saw with Franklin Roosevelt. It's only the domain of the federal government to deal with this. And in the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, basically what LaRouche did is establish the essential principles of Roosevelt's bank holiday, bank reorganization, and his ban on foreclosures. Those were actions that were taken in the first 30 days of the FDR presidency. And so we're saying we've got to reassert the power of the federal government over private money. And that's the concept of a firewall that LaRouche is proposing. So the best that the states can do is move heaven and earth to force Congress to take the appropriate action. What we need to get is LaRouche's bill introduced and then passed by the Congress with a veto-proof majority. So we create the protection so we don't have tens of millions of Americans out on the street in the next 12 months. And we don't have a crisis that winds up completely disrupting our chartered federal and state banks that have to keep their doors open and have to stay intact in order to get an economic recovery going. So under our system, those measures have to be taken by the federal government. Congress has the sole authority, the House of Representatives, to pass legislation that, in effect, generates credit into the economy, state credit. And that's the way our system works. We're not a monetary system. We're a state credit system. And the states have to be the truth squads because they're much closer to the actual state of affairs on the ground of the American citizens. And they've got to pound down the doors of Congress and work with us under Lynn's leadership to make sure that Congress does the right thing. That's the way our federal system functions, and it should not be changed in any way.
Nick, you spent some time lobbying in Austin. Do you think some of these staffers in Austin have a sense that that's their responsibility?
Not yet. I mean, most of them, no. But that can change. I thought we've had a couple of offices that are working with us pretty closely and want to work more. One even asked us to put together a presentation on the collapse, how the collapse of the economy nationwide and in Texas is going. But the good thing that we have right now in this level, in this fight, is that the situation is on our side in the sense that we're presenting to these people what the solution is, and there's no other solution. And there does need to be this paradigm shift. And the motion for it is going to have to come from the third level or fourth level, let's say, political layers, the state legislators and the people in the communities. Then we're going to have to move at the present time, the most worthless leadership, which is the top rung, the federal Congress, who's doing nothing. I mean, like Lynn was saying, they have an 18% approval rating in the population. And so we have a large part of the country covered in our organizing. We have the West Coast covered, all up and down the West Coast. We have New England. We're hitting Virginia, which is a ground zero for the housing collapse. We're hitting Texas, Louisiana, this area down in the south. And then, of course, all through the Rust Belt or the Midwest, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, up into, Michigan.
Well, we also now have a resolution before the Florida legislature.
Right. And most of the legislators aren't even in session. But we still, nonetheless, have a very good number of them that have put forward the resolutions in the houses that are in session. We are, I think, accessing a great amount of the population. And this thing is reaching a point of explosion that I think can go in the direction that LaRouche is saying it needs to.
Let me give Delonte the last word, whatever you want to bring up, Delonte. We got about a minute and a half.
I won't say too much more outside of the same thing these guys said. The base has to continue just working with us. You know, come to the website, and the feedback from the population is absolutely necessary. If you want to get a sense of how this organization gets its intellectual power to do the kind of courageous things that they're doing, by far, go check out what our academy, our intellectual academy is doing in the basement, as they call it, which is in the vicinity of LaRouche, on our website at www.wlym.com/tildeanimations. And you'll get a really clear and definition of how our scientific and intellectual work sort of fosters this kind of political motion.
Well, and this is the new renaissance that Lynn has been fighting for since I've known him back in 1972. And without a renaissance, what you have is stupid little people who can be easily manipulated by the British Empire. I want to thank our guests today, Jeffrey Steinberg, Delonte Bess, and Nick Walsh. Be sure to check out on LaRouchePub.com to get Jeff's latest writing on these strategic matters, along with the on LaRouchePack.com, the LaRouche webcast, the historic webcast from last Wednesday. And check out what Delonte and his crew are doing to keep you updated so you can be effective in this fight. That's it for the LaRouche Show for today. Join us next Saturday when we'll be back again. Thank you.